Thank you very much, Ellie, for arranging the seminar and a nice introduction. So hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. So I'm going to be talking about some recent work I've been doing with Xiao Weiwei and Antonis Pavitsiotis in Singapore. Okay. So last year, I was visiting Perimeter. I gave a talk, and it was on a preliminary version of this paper here. Okay, very first draft we put on the archive. You know, and through talking to people here and other places, they give us lots of nice ideas, so we've added a lot more. Okay, so there's a lot more in this paper now, and we have these follow-up papers. Okay, so if you have any questions or comments, just interrupt me or talk to me sometime. I'll be in Ellie's office all week, so please stop by. Happy to chat. So with that said, I'm going to be talking about device-independent characterizations of quantum states. So what's the idea? Well, device independence, so imagine you have this big device here and you really have no idea what's going on, okay? So there's these three people, they're looking at this. Now this is a big device and they have no idea because it's so complicated, okay? But you could think of a quantum mechanical device where really you have no way of knowing what's going on, okay? Like the person you sold it, who sold it to you may not be trustworthy. They may be leaking some kind of information if it's a cryptographic device or whatever, okay? But, you know, perhaps there's some way to avoid this, okay? Or I guess, you know, the big picture is, can we infer any information about what's happening in some kind of quantum mechanical device by only interacting with it classically, okay? Suppose that maybe there's some kind of settings on it or some outcomes and using only this information, okay? So this is going to be, the first thing we're going to look at is Hilbert space dimension. So here's Alice, okay? Don't worry, Bob's coming in a second. But she has this kind of device here, okay? So this is a digital watch, but for purposes of this talk, let's assume it's some kind of quantum mechanical device, okay? You know, we never really break these things open to find out what's inside anyway. So what Alice is going to do is interact with it in a classical manner, okay? So on the side, we have some buttons right here. And when you hit the buttons, you have some kind of display, okay? So you have some input and some output. If it's a quantum mechanical device, you can assume that these are going to perform some kind of quantum measurement, okay? And this is going to display the outcome of the measurement, okay? And these statistics, maybe we can tell what's happening inside this device, okay? So here's Bob, and we're going to assume he has his own device, okay? But they're separated by some distance, okay? So the devices are not communicating. But they could be entangled, say. All right? And he has his own button presses, his own outcomes. So Alice here, this is just some notation. Alice has some measurement settings X here, or some inputs, and outputs A. And Bob has Y, and he's going to get his own outcome B. All right? And what we're going to do is look at the probabilities that these guys occur. Okay, so this is the joint conditional probabilities. If Alice hits X and Bob hits Y, then we have some probability that Alice sees A and Bob sees B. Okay? They could be correlated, could be independent, whatever. Okay? But we're going to assume they satisfy the laws of quantum mechanics, and they could be entangled with product measurements. All right? Is the setting clear? So whenever I talk about device independence in this setting, we're going to look at the probabilities and only the probabilities, and we want to infer some information about these devices. So from these probabilities, what is going on in here? And the first thing we're going to do is bound the Hilbert space dimension. Okay? So given a quantum correlation P, so the set of all the probabilities, Alice and Bob must each have a Hilbert space of dimension at least these two quantities. Okay? So these two quantities, they look a little nasty, but they're okay. Basically, they're just a function of the probabilities. Okay? There's nothing much more going on here. Take some square roots, you're adding some things. These minimums are all discrete minimums, so you don't have to solve any hard problems. Okay? So this is something you can easily do on a computer or get a grad student to solve who has some time, but you really just plug it in and get something out. Okay? And these are device independent. They only depend on the probabilities. So notice there's no measurements here. There's no mention of quantum states. Okay, so.
Are you saying those two quantities are equal?
No. What I'm saying is that they're both lower bounds. So Alice and Bob each have a Hilbert space, and this is going to be a lower bound on both of them, and so is the other one. And sometimes one, you'll use one and not the other. Yep. So here's a proof. So this is not the original proof that's in the paper. This is actually a recent proof. But I think it's a lot more illustrative of what's going on. And really, all the information we're going to get comes from this state here. So this is Alice's reduced state. We're going to square it and take the trace. Okay, so this is a measure of the purity, if you've seen it before. What we're going to do is take Alice's reduced state and decompose it in two different ways. So we have two copies right here. First, we're going to assume Bob measures the state, his part of the system, with measurement y1. Okay? And this is a way to represent Alice's state. So she has some collection of post-measured states, but it's not going to affect her overall state, her overall density matrix. Okay, so you can do it for this measurement, and you can do it independently with a different measurement for y1, or so for y2 for Bob. Okay, so any measurements on Bob's side. Just clean it up a bit. The trace of two matrices is less than or equal to the fidelity squared. Okay, and just some algebra. And now fidelity, once we have fidelity, we can finish up because the fidelity can only increase if you apply a quantum channel to both the inputs. And what is the quantum channel now? Well, it's going to be basically Alice's measurement. She's going to choose a measurement x here, apply the measurement on her state, and not look at the outcome. Okay? So it's going to map, basically it's going to map a density matrix to a diagonal matrix, and the diagonals are going to contain all the measurement probabilities. Okay? And this is usually, when we think of measurements as channels, this is what we're talking about. And now, whenever Alice applies some measurement on a post-measured state, we're basically just going to have the probabilities popping out at the end. Okay? So now we've reduced the state, rho A, down to these probabilities, and we can clean up because if you take the trace of rho A squared, or just any quantum state for that matter, it's always greater or equal to the 1 over the size of the Hilbert space dimension. All right? So you just kind of put all the mins and maxes in the right spots and isolate this D and you get our bound. Okay. The reason I like this proof, the original proof was very algebraic. We basically sat down and said, hey, this is the definition of a quantum correlation. And we just kind of did some algebra and came up with some lemmas. And then at the end of the day, we had our bound. But what was going on was a little hidden. Okay? And this cleans it up quite a bit. So intuitively, we have these post-measured states. Yeah?
I'm just curious why we're not talking about probabilities of A given B1, X, Y1, because you know, your 5X given row B1 would really be, you know, if Bob has gotten the outcome B1.
Yes, exactly. So what you have to do is you just take into the normalization of the state into account. So you have the probability of A given B, X, Y, and then the normalization,
okay,
and then,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, yep.
Exactly. So now, why do we need a large Hilbert space dimension? Well, this now speaks about the steerability of Bob's measurements. If Bob's measurements are steering states that are quite orthogonal, or you know, orthogonal feeling under this fidelity measure, then you know, once you have a lot of orthogonal feeling things, you need a large Hilbert space dimension to accommodate these dimensions. Okay. So that's basically what's happening. Okay, so that's the proof. How tight is the bound? Well, the first thing you know most people try is CHSH. So this has binary inputs, binary outputs. They're inputs and outputs. And if A and B, X, Y satisfy these two relations, you'll get these two probabilities. Okay, so this is a famous correlation. This maximally violates Bell's inequality. Okay. If you've seen that, and the lower bound equals 2 exactly. Okay? And this is something you can do with a maximally entangled pair of qubits. Okay? So this is tight, exactly tight, you don't have to round. Magic Square. So Magic Square, I'm not going to go into the background, what's going on. I just wanted to say that it has three inputs for Alice and Bob now. Okay, and each of them have 8 outputs. Okay, so this is a bit of a larger example. And the probabilities satisfy this, but it doesn't really matter. You can plug it into our bound, and you get 4. Okay, and this is a correlation you can generate using 2 pairs of maximally entangled qubits. So this is a tight bound as well. And BB84, so this is the easiest way to describe this correlation is if they share maximally entangled state, if they measure in the same basis, orthonormal basis, they'll get the same outcome, okay? So A equals B with 1/2, and they never disagree, so they're perfectly correlated. But if they measure in 2 complementary bases, then they're going to be independent uniform outcomes. Okay? So this is like, you can think of these as the BB84 states. And a lower bound equals 2 exactly here as well. Okay, so you know we're off to a good start. All right. Now, is it always tight? So every time I discuss Hilbert space dimension with people, it never fails. Someone always asks me about I3322. Okay, because this is an example of correlations with large Hilbert space dimension, and people want to prove this. Okay, so let me just get this out of the way and say our bound is not tight for this. Okay, so it actually fails. It fails quite remarkably. And this is why. So a limitation of our bound is that it doesn't change very much with small perturbations in the data. Okay? So let me be a little more precise. If with positive probabilities, if we are able to bring them down just a little bit and change the perturbation or change the probabilities a little bit, our bound is quite continuous in this way, and it will not change. You'll not get large fluctuations in Hilbert space dimension. Now, we talked to Paul and Vertesi, and we got some data for I3322. And the probability, whenever they change Hilbert space dimensions, the correlations do not change very much at all. Okay, the probabilities are very, very, very close together. Okay, whether you use a 49-dimensional Hilbert space or 200-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, and so ours eventually gets stuck, and it doesn't grow anymore, where the Hilbert space dimension seems to want to increase. So this is a limitation, I would say, of our bound. Any good Hilbert space dimension bound should be able to account for this. Okay? But I would say a strength is that our lower bound does not change much with small perturbations in the data. Okay? If you're testing things in the laboratory, you're never going to get perfect statistics. Okay? You're just going to get all these numbers. And at the end, you just come up with some good approximation or some good guess what it is. Okay? And as the probabilities get closer and closer to the true values, okay, you don't want your Hilbert space guess. It'd be nice if it didn't jump all over the place. It'd be nice if it kind of had this converging type feel to it as the data converges. Okay? So there is some kind of trade-off between a real lower bound on the Hilbert space dimension and how useful it'd be in the laboratory. Okay? Okay, so another thing we can do with our bound is rule out quantum sources. So a correlation P is not quantum if it satisfies this. Okay, again, doesn't matter, you won't have to memorize this, but basically our bound was 1 over some quantity, some function of the P's. You just set this function to 0, and then you can say these P's cannot be generated by something quantum. Okay, and that's exactly what this is here. An interpretation of what this is just looking at patterns of zeros. If your correlation has 0 probabilities in certain spots, you can rule it out. Here's an example of such a correlation, the Pierre box. So Pierre box is a very nice correlation. In a sense, I think of it as what CHSH wants to be, okay? But was not bound by quantum mechanics. It would look like this. You have 1/2 up here, and you have zeros down here. So sometimes they're perfectly correlated, and sometimes they're perfectly not correlated. And if you apply this R bound to it, you get that this is not quantum. A D box, generalizing this, so now Alice and Bob still have 2 binary inputs, but now they have many outputs, well, D of them. If you look at this generalization, you can also rule it out from being quantum. So this is also not quantum. So I'm not going to go into details about no signaling correlations too much, but they form a nice polytope. It's a superset of the quantum set. And if you look at any non-local extreme points of this set, in this case, when Alice and Bob have two measurement outcomes, this is still rules it out from being quantum. Okay? And whenever, and this is basically what they look like whenever there's two inputs, so two measurement settings look like this, and two measurement outcomes. I didn't write it down, but it also rules it out. So we're actually able to rule out quite a few things. Here's a larger example. Okay? This is whenever Alice and Bob have three inputs and three outputs. So this is, these are the measurement settings up here, and the cells correspond to the outcomes for A and B. If you apply a lower bound to this, which is a larger example, we can also rule it out. Okay? So all the extreme points we've tried, it seems to work out. In fact, there's not that many classifications. As far as I know, these are the only classifications of these extreme points, this guy and this guy. So it's ruling out everything we've tried. I don't expect it to work for everything. It hardly works for this one. It just squeezes by to rule this out. Okay? So imagine if you have more inputs and outputs, it might not eventually work. But finding these extreme points are hard. Yeah?
Can you clarify when you first introduced this, the idea was that if you have zeros in the probability distribution, mm-hmm. that puts a zero in the denominator of
yes.
the lower bound?
That's right.
But how's that not consistent with their admitting a quantum solution which is just infinite dimensional?
I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
Right here.
So thus far you've been saying we're ruling out finite dimensional accounts.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Got
yes.
It.
Yes. So I wasn't going to sweep that under the rug, I was going to get to that. So what we're doing is ruling out finite dimensional quantum systems for generating these correlations. Okay? Now, whenever I first saw this, I thought it was a bit unfortunate. Like, you know, PR box, you can rule out infinite dimensional representations. And, you know, I thought it would have been nice if we can always do these infinite dimensional things. Okay? But then I was talking to Valerio Scarani about this. And he's like, he came up to me after a talk and said, you know, this finite dimensional thing. I thought he was going to, you know, say it was bad. He actually said, this is really interesting. I said, well, what do you mean? So here's the thing. People don't know if there's correlations that can be generated with an infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces dimension, but cannot be generated with finite dimensional ones. Okay? So in theory, a bound, I don't know if our bound will be able to do this. This is very new, it's not on the paper. I don't know if our bound will be able to do this, but such a bound could have interesting consequences. Okay? And just to say something more on this, maybe something a little more philosophical, you can imagine an experiment, Bell setting or not, and it's reproducing statistics that can only be generated using infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Okay? And you can bound how close these correlations can get with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Okay? If you could have this, then you have some confidence that the world is actually infinite dimensional. I don't have any strong feelings whether people think the world is finite dimensional or infinite dimensional. Okay? If anyone does have strong feelings, I'd be very interested to hear about it. But this would be something a little bit like Bell's original experiment that ruled out local hidden variable models and said the world is actually quantum. Maybe we could have something that says, hey, look, the world's actually infinite dimensional, not finite dimensional.
Do you have any examples where the ruled out is finite dimensional, but you actually have a model
there are examples now which of correlations that can not be generated with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, tensor measurements, tensor Park measurements, but can be generated by infinite dimensional commuting measurements. This is very new work by William Slofstra at IQC.
You spoke about that.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
actually what I'm talking about is infinite dimensional tensor product measurements.
Yeah.
So this is a set that lies in between the two. And it's an open question whether these two are different or not. Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. So another application, which is basically based on Ellie's work, okay, is proving non-convexity of some sets of correlations. So whenever I say the set of quantum correlations, I'm not restricting the amount of resources, the size of the Hilbert space dimensions for Alice and Bob. Right here, imagine if we do consider the set of all correlations that can be generated by, say, just qubits. Okay. Now we can ask whether the set is convex or not. Okay, so I won't go into the details. These are some easy correlations that can be generated with qubits. In fact, you don't even need qubits. And if you apply our lower bound, you can show that a lower bound evaluates to something strictly larger than 2. So qubits cannot generate the midpoint of these three correlations. Okay? And this was also shown by Yali. So this gives alternative proof. Okay? And something... So we're thinking about these non-local games and how you have these perfect parallel repetition. We're wondering what we could say with ours. So what if you had product correlations? So Alice and Bob are just going to repeat the same experiment, let's say it's CHSH, 6 times same. What can you say about the Hilbert space dimension of all 6 of these guys? Okay. So it could be, so for one particular experiment, you know that Alice and Bob need to have Hilbert space dimension at least 2. But maybe if they repeat, they can somehow squeeze it down and have a smaller Hilbert space. Like maybe if Alice needs to do 6 of them, she could have some savings. Okay? But our lower bounds multiply. Okay? So we can show that in this case, for product correlations, the best Alice can do is having a qubit in each system. Okay? And there's lots of results on CHSH and how it how the strategies work in parallel and sequence and all this stuff. But this is a little bit different. You can also talk about if you had, this guy could be CHSH, this guy could be BB84, this guy could be Magic Square, they could be anything. And the lower bounds just spread out and multiply. Okay.
Mm-hmm. This works in general, anytime you have a product distribution, mm-hmm. The Hilbert space dimension of the product distribution is the product of the lower bounds?
What I'm saying is our lower bounds multiply.
Yeah.
So if our lower bounds are not tight, right, then we're just getting some kind of multiplicative lower bound on the entire thing. If it's exactly tight, then it shows it multiplies.
And you found an instance where you have like a fractional lower bound, and then a certain multiplication factor,
yes,
it becomes an integer, and so then you might actually have savings?
Yeah, that could be true. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so that's what I want to say about the bell setting for now. Are there any questions? So we're going to look at a very similar flavored analysis, but now we're going to look at the prepare measure scenario. Okay. Prepare measure scenario, there's still Alice and Bob. But Alice is going to choose some kind of x here. And now it's not a measurement setting, but a preparation setting. And she's going to prepare some quantum state, send it to Bob, put it inside his device, and he's going to make some measurement. Okay, so he can also have some choices of measurement y here, and he gets b. But Alice has no outcome now. So now we're just going to look at the set of probabilities b conditioned on x and y. Okay. And this is prepare measure correlation. And we have the same question. If the devices are quantum, how large is the Hilbert space? How large is the state that Alice sent to Bob? Whatever. And how large is Bob's measurement? Okay. And we have a very similar looking bound. And you know, there's a reason it's similar. I'll get to that in a second. But basically, this quantity here is a lower bound on the Hilbert space dimension. And this is a function of p's here. And this works for any probability distribution Q over the preparations. Okay. So this is a hard quantity to compute now. If you want, you can just put Q equals uniform and get something nice to compute. But we wanted the full generality, so we put it there. And also, this is an extremely hard problem to optimize. Like if you just ask what is the best Q here, this is a non-convex optimization problem, and it's hard to solve. So we just left it in the theorem. And that's what we have. But these Qs can be anything. You take the maximum. But note, in this case, it's a little bit different than the Bell scenario because the dimension can always be upper bounded by the number of preparations. Okay? Does someone see why this is true? Let me ask again. There, in a different way, Alice has some state she can send such that Bob can generate any kind of statistics he wants for any prepare measure scenario. Well, Alice could just send X, the entire description of X. Okay? So in some sense, she's not compressing it at all. Just saying the entire description to Bob, Bob can do whatever he wants. Yeah. But anyway, the lower bound is still meaningful, even though there's a finite limit on the upper bound. The algebraic proof, which we found after, is almost the exact same ideas. Okay, but now we're decomposing rho here, and I'm basically defining rho to be some kind of convex combination of all the preparations. Okay, so this is a nice density operator. And this is the same Q here, and you can use any Q you want. And that's why it shows up in our theorem. Okay. Here's a more interesting proof. What we can do is put the prepare measure scenario, put it into a Bell setting. And I believe this is pretty standard. Alice and Bob are going to share this state right here. Okay, so this is where Q is showing up now. And if she's going to measure this in the computational basis. And if she does that, she's going to get some X with some probability, well, 2X. And then Bob is going to have the state, the preparation of rho X. Okay, so this is kind of a probabilistic way of sending the state rho to Bob. Yeah. So you could just type down the probabilities in the Bell correlation now, apply our Bell correlation lower bound on Hilbert space dimension, and you're bounding the Hilbert space dimension of this thing, which is exactly what we wanted. Yeah. But what's kind of interesting here is that in the Bell setting, there was two lower bounds. Okay. And here, you can apply the two lower bounds, but one is provably better than the other one. So that's why in this theorem, you only saw the one bound. Yeah. So one example of prepare measure is random access coding. This is whenever Alice here has an n-bit string, she's going to encode it into some state, preferably of small Hilbert space dimension. And Bob is going to choose some index, so 1 to n. So he could choose the first bit, the second bit, so forth. And then he's going to perform a measurement to try to extract the information of xi. Okay, so he doesn't care about the rest of the string at all. He just wants the ith bit. Okay? And the question is, can Alice, she could always send over the entire string, and then Bob would have nice information. But is there some kind of compression she can do? Okay, some kind of saving on quantum resources and send over a smaller state? So in terms of the correlation, the probabilities could look like this. So if Alice prepares X and Bob wants to learn XI, he is correct with probability beta, and he's incorrect with probability 1 minus beta. All right. So those are the probabilities. And here is a nice graph. So this is whenever Alice has 2 bits. She wants to encode 2 bits. Well, depending on the success probability here, she can possibly have some kind of savings in the resources. Okay? So right here, let's look at the extreme cases first. When beta equals 1/2, this is no better than Bob randomly guessing. He's effectively not even looking at the quantum state, so the dimension is 1. Basically, there's no state there. Okay? And this makes sense. Now, what if he wants to learn them both perfectly? Okay? Or at least near perfect? Then Alice can do no better than sending both the bits. Okay. And there's this nice trade-off between the two. All right. And also note, so this is the exact lower bound, but Hilbert space dimension has this nice property of being an integer. So technically, you're just rounding both of these up to the ceiling, which is the closest integer going up. Okay. Now, You notice here I have a blue line, which is Naix bound. Okay? So you may think I'm a bad salesman by showing a bound that's better than ours. But there's two reasons I put Naix bound here. One is that Ashwin Naik is my PhD supervisor, so I find I should take every chance I get to compliment his work. It's a very fantastic bound. Second of all, it is essentially optimal. Okay, so you for large examples, you cannot do much better than Naix bound. Okay. So getting close to something essentially optimal is a good thing. Okay, so that's why I put it there. But there's a few more things we can say. Our bound is close to Naix for small random access codes. So for larger random access codes, like if you want to encode 10 bits into a quantum state, our bound does kind of have a hard time. Okay, where Naix bound stays strong, our bound does get a little bit below Naix bound. Okay? On the other hand, our bound is more flexible. So for Naix bound, you only look at the worst case decoding probability. And basically, that's the only probability that's taken into account, where ours looks at all the probabilities. So if some are good and some are bad, it can take advantage of all of them, okay? Like global information. In terms of optimization, we can actually solve for the optimal Q here in this case. And it turns out to be uniform, okay? Just because the probabilities are so nicely structured. Okay? And this is just some kind of convex optimization. Okay, I'll just mention this very quickly, the impossibility of compressing your state. So before we had this impossibility of quantum representation, okay, like for PR boxes and such. And now we're going to say, well, every PM correlation is technically quantum. You can basically generate everything. So it doesn't make sense what's quantum and what's not quantum now. What we're going to do is look at what's impossible to compress. So I said there's an upper bound of the number of preparations. And then we can look at this property right here. And if it's the probability satisfy this this property, then we can say that the lower bound is equal to n, or the number of preparations as well. Okay, so the lower bound matches the upper bound exactly. Okay. And this is quite easy to see if you stare at the lower bound long enough. Okay, and this is something that happens in the random access codes. Okay, so I won't talk about this too much. Basically, we're able to recover some other dimension witnesses or dimension bounds in other papers, some nonlinear ones, some linear ones. Here's a nice linear one by Brunner, Nevesquiz, and Vertesi. And we're able to recover this. So this case only works for certain choices of Bob's measurements. Okay. So if we apply R bound to this, we get something a little bit more general. Okay, we can have any y here, and we get a stronger bound. Okay, so it's comparable to some other nice results in the literature. Yeah, and the proof of this is quite different than ours. This was based on state discrimination. And non-convexity. So we can do the same thing. So I guess I'm not sure if it's proven somewhere or if it's just folklore. But these sets of prepare measure correlations are non-convex. Okay, we weren't able to find a proof, but I believe it's mentioned in some papers. So we gave a proof of this. So this is kind of a twist on random access coding, but instead of outputting a guess, a 0-1, you're allowed to say, I don't know. Okay. And if you take the midpoint of these correlations can be generated by qubits, but the midpoint cannot be. Okay, so very similar proof to Ellie's result. Okay. Okay, any questions about prepare and measure? I'm about to take this step back to Bell settings in a second. Yep.
I wonder, do your techniques also allow you to get dimension bounds if your data just is not prepared measure, but you know, you're just given the distributions of some alternate measurements? So I tell you, there's a number of different types of measurements that have been done in this one system, and here are the distributions. Hmm. What's a lower bound on the dimension quantum system that could generate that?
So kind of like the prepare and measure and measure and measure and measure setting?
No, like no, I'm just imagining more like the measure setting, right? So here you had a variable X, which varied Alice's preparations. You know,
yes.
She was realizing different convex decompositions of the same state, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah.
But you could just remove that part and say, no, Alice is just preparing that state row. There's no variability there. But you know that a number of different measurement settings exist. So there's a Y variable, mm-hmm. and each there's some B outcome. And so you just have a description of the different P of B given Ys that you can see.
Yeah.
And then the question is just what's the smallest dimension that could generate that?
So there's one measurement, or you're repeating measurements?
Just one measurement. So I'm imagining that, like in all of the scenarios you've been talking about, mm-hmm. you have access to the different probability distributions that could occur if that measurement setting was y equal to 1, if that measurement setting was y equal to 2.
Right.
But there are no consecutive measurements. It's just different counterfactual possibilities for what that measurement was.
Yes. I'm not sure.
The point is just to have only one preparation.
Yeah.
So isn't it, because you're considering also P of the others here?
Yes, general measurements.
So couldn't you then think of that sort of preparation as being an ancilla? And you just send the one dimensional state to see if those do it to dimension one. Is that?
Well, whenever you start expanding the Hilbert space, like this takes into account. So if you're looking at POVMs.
Oh, this takes into account the required.
Yeah, everything. Well. Everything. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah,
I have a question as well. If you. In a prepare and measure scenario, you can also allow Alice's box to have an outcome on it. So mm-hmm. you could have an A there as well as the outcome.
Oh, I see.
On Bob's box.
Uh-huh.
So then, it's only that light flashes that you were successful. So the joint the total probability is less than one in some sense.
I see.
Those outcomes. And then it's more similar, at least formally, to the bell case.
Yeah, but you have some bit of communication.
I wonder. For example, then you said you get these two bounds, but in the prepare and measure case, you said one bound always trumps the other bound.
Yes.
I wonder if that would still be the case, for example, if you drop this, if you consider it also.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it could be the case that the other bound that does not do very well kind of comes in, the strength comes out in this scenario. Yeah, it could be. It wouldn't surprise me, actually, yeah. Any more questions? Yeah, I'm leaving prepare and measure. Last chance. Oh, you're going to ask me later. OK, so now what I want to do is look at some characterizations of the state, not just of the Hilbert space dimension, but of the actual state itself in the Bell scenario. So this is what it looks like, if you forgot. And we're going to need a little fact first. What we're going to do is show that pure states are sufficient. So, and this is in a Bell scenario. Now, you can always say Bell states are pure states are sufficient by purifying the space of Alice or Bob. Okay, one of them can hold a purification, but this increases the Hilbert space dimension of one of them. Okay? What you can do is assume it's pure without increasing either Hilbert space dimension. Okay, and this is something we've been using. Okay, I won't go into the proof too much. Basically, you purify. You perform some kind of nice isometries, and you bring it back down. So you increase the Hilbert space dimension, then you bring it back down. Okay? And if you do this, you can actually assume that Alice and Bob have the same dimension in Hilbert space. So if you start with a lopsided experiment, you can always assume it's pure and make sure they're both small Hilbert space dimensions, like the minimum of the two. Now, why do I care about pure states? Well, I want to talk about Schmidt coefficients. Okay, and if you talk about Schmidt coefficients, you should have a pure state. Now the question is, now we have pure states, can we squeeze out a little bit more of an old proof? Okay. So this trace of rho A squared, if you look at it a little bit closer, you can actually write this down. This is a function of the Schmidt coefficients. Okay. So now we have the sum of the lambda I squares. So the sum of the lambda I's equals 1. Clear that up. Now, if you square them, you get the 1 over d here. Okay. So, as Ellie said, now we're using the whole buffalo. We're getting more information that we weren't using, we didn't see before. Yeah? And just by looking at that old proof, we see that if this pure state generates a quantum correlation P here, then the Schmidt coefficients lambda must satisfy this. So this was basically a Hilbert space dimension bound before, but now we're doing the Schmidt coefficient. Okay? And if you don't like the fact that I was using pure states, you can replace this with the eigenvalues of the reduced states for Alice or Bob. Okay? But I'll assume pure states from here on out. And lower bounds don't exist. Okay? So why don't they exist? You can always, Alice and Bob can always just tack on more states. Okay? They could have some EPR pairs that are redundant, they're not being measured, but still they're still generating the same statistics. And if you look at this quantity over here, it's just going to go down. So if you have lots of EPR pairs, this quantity gets closer and closer to zero. So lower bounds don't exist. So this is why an upper bound is a, you know, a meaningful quantity to bound. Okay? Like before, it doesn't make sense to have, an upper bound on Hilbert space dimension, because your dimension could be larger. You're just not using any of the extra space you have. Okay? So this, we trivially recover everything we had before, because now it's a little bit stronger. Can we say anything else? Well, now what we can do is bound the entropy. Okay? So this Renyi entropy is defined like this. So for any n, you can have this quantity here. So you're looking at the nth power of some quantum state. And what we're able to bound is the trace of rho squared. So we can bound this entropy right here whenever n equals 2. And the von Neumann entropy, this is a little bit more well known, is the limit as n goes to 1 of these generalized entropies. Okay? So now if you, so it's a limit, but it also, it increases. Okay, as n gets smaller, the entropy is going to get larger. Did I say that right? No, the opposite. Yeah, the von Neumann entropy is the larger one. Okay? So now if you look at the reduced state on Alice's side, this guy is going to be larger than S2 rho A, which is something we can bound. And this is going to be larger than these quantities here. Okay, and these are the two bounds I had on the previous slide. I just don't want to write them again. So you just plug them in, and now we have a lower bound on the von Neumann entropy. Okay? And this is optimal for CHSH, magic square, BB84, all the nice correlations we had before. This is saying that you need 1 bit of entropy or magic square, you need 2 bits of entropy. And for I3322, so I don't know much about this correlation, not as much as I would like, but the thing is that there's the Hilbert space dimension seems to need to get larger and larger. Okay? But all because you have large Hilbert space dimension does not mean you have lots of entropy. Okay? So now we at least have some lower bound on the entropy, and I'm sure it's not tight. I don't know how tight it is. Maybe I'd like to figure it out. But we only have, you know, 0.67 EPR pairs of entropy. Okay, and this is the Hilbert space dimension of the numbers we ran, 49 dimensional. Okay, so it's some bound. I don't know if it's good, but it's something we can do. And another thing we can do is pure state uniqueness. Okay, so here's CHSH again. From our bounds, there's an upper bound on the Schmidt coefficients, this function. It's 1/2. Now suppose you use a state of minimum dimension, that is a qubit-qubit pair for Alice and Bob. There's only one state that can generate, that can satisfy this. And that's a maximally entangled state. Okay? So if Alice and Bob are generating CHSH statistics, and they have a state of minimum dimension, then it has to be maximally entangled. Okay? So this is, you know, there are stronger statements known for CHSH. You know, it's very robust, and there's some self-testing results, and et cetera. But this is something we get for free. Okay? And this also works for, I think it also works for BB84, magic square, you know, my favorite correlations, works for all these. So whenever your state is maximally entangled and at minimum dimension, it has to be unique. Okay. Yep. So here's another bound that's completely different than what I've said before. So given a state psi that generates the correlation P, the minimum of the Schmidt coefficients is upper bounded by this quantity. Okay? So these are the marginal probabilities for Alice and Bob. So these are the statistics Alice gets if she doesn't even care about what's happening on Bob's side. Okay? Just the probability she gets A on input X, and Bob, we look at his as well. Okay? So on the top, you have the product of the marginals, and on the bottom, you have the full information. You take the minimum over ABXY, and this is an upper bound on the smallest non-zero Schmidt coefficient. Okay? And for the same reason, upper bounds don't exist. And if you have a mixed state, if you wanted, you can put an eigenvalue there if you want. Okay? It's not a problem. Okay? So just as the other function of the Schmidt coefficients was able to pin down a state exactly, okay, assuming some dimensions, what we're able to do now is rule out states. So suppose you have a correlation. You calculate our bound on the minimum Schmidt coefficient. If it's strictly less than 1 over d, then you know the state cannot be maximally entangled if it's of dimension d. Okay? So now we're kind of playing the opposite role, ruling out states. And here's a partial correlation. Suppose for some measurement of Alice and Bob, these are the statistics they get. So they'll get either 1, 2, or 3 each. And they agree if it's 1 over 10. Sorry, with probability 1 over 10, they agree. And with some small probabilities, they're going to be different. Okay. And here, the probabilities can be anything. Doesn't matter. Our bound says the small Schmidt coefficient has to be at most 18 over 125, okay, which is quite small. Okay. Alternatively, if suppose this is the entire correlation, Alice and Bob only have one measurement setting each. Then you can prove that the state of minimum dimension that generates this has dimension either 2 or 3. Okay? So if you combine these results, the state of minimum dimension cannot be maximally entangled. Okay? In fact, there's some kind of distance. You can bound it away. So if it has qubits, you can actually bound it really far away from maximally entanglement. Okay, so those are some Schmidt things we can do with Schmidt coefficients. What's the next step? So, can we find non-trivial bounds for classical correlations? Okay, so the bounds on the quantum resources give bounds on the classical resources, some trivial bounds. But are there stronger bounds we can put on classical resources? Okay. You know, there are some correlations that can be generated at qubits, but you need at least 4 bits of shared randomness. Sorry, 1 qubit and 2 classical bits. Those are, yeah. Okay. So it'd be very nice. We have some kind of bounds. I don't know how strong they are yet, but you know, there's progress being made. Can we extend the bounds to handle more y's? And what do I mean by that? All the bounds had a maximum over y1, y2. Okay. Can we handle more y's? And this is an artifact of the fact that in the proof we had a fidelity. Okay, and the fidelity has this nice property. It really likes to have 2 inputs. If you try to give it more inputs, it's going to get angry. Okay? And that's why we have 2 y's. So is there a way to get more than 1 y? Okay. Can be extended to more than 2 parties? Yeah, I think this is a very interesting problem. Everything we have now is just for 2 parties. And even defining the minimum Hilbert space dimension for, say, 3 parties is an interesting task. Yeah, I'm not sure how to even define this. Okay, so you know, there are some options, but you know, you have to argue what you're doing. Similar techniques to self-testing. Okay. Self-testing is a really hot topic lately. There's been lots of papers on the archive recently. I won't talk too much about it. But it's very interesting. It's basically a more robust version of the results I had where you can pin down the states exactly. Are there other interesting scenarios to which these bounds can be applied? Okay. So there's bell settings, there's prepare and measure. but there's no reason we can't try other settings, you know? So I think we can apply our settings to something like prepare and broadcast scenario, which is basically you have someone preparing the states for a bell setting. I'm pretty sure it works here. There's triangle scenarios. There's scenarios where there's basically a bunch of classical communication, and then you just say, hey, now, listen, everyone has entanglement. Can you get new probabilities? How much Hilbert space dimension do you need to get all these new probabilities? Okay, so there's really a lot of questions that we can ask. Okay. And that's it. Thank you very much. Any questions?
I'm curious about the fact that you introduced POVMs, so then effectively the dimension you're getting is the one where you would take into account the ancillas required.
That's right.
And really, you're assuming basically PV measurements in essence.
So if you have projective measurements, then the Hilbert space dimension has to increase by a little bit. You're basically doing Neymark's theorem and all this stuff. Right. It is increasing a little bit. So Hilbert space dimension bounds have to take this into account, but what it doesn't change is the Schmidt coefficients.
So that was going to be my question. So if you, because what's really interesting is the sort of the amount of Hilbert space dimension that's required between Alice and Bob, for example, mm-hmm. the bell-type scenario. And if you introduce POVMs, that would require the dimension of the overall Hilbert space to be bigger, perhaps.
That's right, yeah.
But that's not as interesting as the dimension of the Hilbert space of the part of the systems that carry the correlation to the two ends. Are you able to lower bound that Hilbert space dimension?
So you're saying, assuming you just have projective measurements?
No, I'm saying allow arbitrary POVMs.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm only interested in the dimension of the lower bound and the dimension of the systems that travel from the source to the two ends.
I think the answer to your earlier question was that dimension bounds don't include the dimension of the ancilla. That these are dimension bounds that hold even if you allow your measurements to be POVMs.
Yes, we're assuming mixed states and POVMs. Yeah.
Okay.
So, for example, the answer to my question earlier was that you can only get trivial bounds because it's a one-dimensional system. I can have a POVM that's just generates any probability distribution I like by taking multiples of identity. And so, if you just don't have any correlations, you just have a bunch of distributions, then you have dimensions.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that you have correlations that's going to teach you that.
Right.
Dimension has to be greater than one.
Right. That's what I'd assume that they'd be down to.
But I think the second part of your answer is just that if you happen to want a bound for projectors, you can get that as well by, maybe I don't quite understand that, but you wanted to sort of Neumark dilate, get a bound. They might get better bounds for, if you're promised that it's going to be a projective measurement, you could get better bounds.
So I know at one point we looked at this. We said, can we get something better? Like completely orthogonal projective measurements and, you know, and at the end of the day, we weren't able to get much. It just didn't lend itself to the proof. Now, I'm not sure about the Schmidt coefficients. Because with the Schmidt coefficients, when you dilate in this way, it doesn't change them at all. So this is when we got excited. We said, OK, now we have all this extra structure. But it seemed not to give us anything, or at least nothing that I could see yet. Yeah.
So I didn't understand when you talked about getting arbitrary correlations from pure states. I mean, your lambda i's throughout the rest of the talk, you said a few times, you can think of these as the eigenvalues of the reduced density operator or as the Schmidt coefficients of some pure state.
Yes.
So your very first result was that any bipartite correlations that can be generated by mixed states can also be generated by a pure state of the same dimension?
Yes, yes.
Can you go back to that? I didn't understand what that was.
Right here. Yeah, so this was essential. I don't think we used this in the original. In the new proof, we don't need this for the Hilbert space bound. But the original proof, we needed this. It was a very key step. So the first thing we do, we take rho, and we purify it on Bob system, say. we have the Schmidt decomposition over here. And then you...
And the bipartition in that Schmidt decomposition...
It's right here. So this is Alice, and these are Bob. And the identity is on Bob's extra space, his purifying space.
Okay, so FIs are defined on now Bob's system and Scylla, and the EIs are on Alice's system.
So yes, that's right.
Okay.
And now what we're going to do is change these the Schmidt bases. So we apply some unitarian on both sides to make them something nice. Just computational basis states.
So maybe that just that on that first step, you're basically saying you can always imagine that the mixedness comes from ignoring an Scylla that's purely on Bob's side. So why is that obvious? That it's sufficient to imagine that I can purify only on Bob's side rather than having to...
So, okay,
or,
so...
Does it not matter where you put the Scylla?
The thing is that it's still generating the same statistics. So this inner product is preserved if Bob just carries the extra purifying subspace and does not measure it.
Oh, I see. So you're just happy to give it to Bob. There's nothing important about giving it to Bob. You just need to put the Scylla somewhere.
Usually what we do is we choose the one who starts with a larger Hilbert space. So in this case, Alice is the smaller one. So we're going to keep her isolated and just worry about Bob.
Okay. So then how do you prove that psi can actually be made smaller dimensional?
So basically what we do is we perform these local isometries on Alice and Bob's side to change the Schmidt basis on Alice and Bob's side to the computational basis states. And these local isometries do not change. It doesn't change the statistics, and it doesn't change the fact that there's still product measurement. So having the product isometries is the important thing here. And after that, the number, the Schmidt values, the coefficients are not increasing. There's still d of them, where d was Alice's Hilbert space dimension.
So the choice of that isometry depends on what m and n are, or does it only depend on psi?
No. But the new measurements, these m prime and n prime, as I call them, they depend on the previous measurements and the isometry. In fact, that's all it is. And then there's all these extra subspaces that are not taken into account. You just throw them away.
Okay, so when you get bounds on the lambda i's, you say, well, if the correlations were generated from pure state, then we can think of these as bounds on the Schmidt coefficients.
Yes.
Of that pure state. But if, in fact, they were generated by mixed state, then the bounds on the eigenvalues
yes.
The reduction.
Yes, and that it's actually... a consequence of the Schmidt coefficients. So we say, okay, assume it's pure. And then if it's mixed, then let's see, what do we do? If it's mixed, then we purify it. And then the eigenvalues of the reduced state equal the Schmidt coefficients on the larger state. And then you just apply the pure state bound. So the mixed state follows from the pure state bound in that way.
So it seems that you only care about the smaller of the two.
In this case, you can care about the smallest of the two, and that way at the end, they're both
right.
Small.
But it'd be interesting to probe cases where you care about both dimensions. And here's an idea of where that might matter.
Okay.
Introduce z as well as x and y, and z is a setting for the source state. So you vary over different source states, then you might be in a position where you want to bound both.
Okay.
Both the direction of the space going towards Alice and the one going towards Bob. Because just a triple example, you could imagine sort of dull states that span different sort of parts of that basis.
Right.
So you'd need more space.
Okay.
And an analogous example, a thing to consider would be transformations. So you have a preparation transformation as a measurement. And you could vary over transformations as well as the other.
Sorry, preparation, transformation, and measurement.
And you'd have an incoming Hilbert space dimension
yeah.
to the transformation, and also an outgoing Hilbert space dimension. It'd be
interesting
to bound both of those.
Yes. There's a related scenario, which is called the classical one-way communication, where Alice has some kind of message M, and she sends it through a noisy channel. And now the input and output is fixed, the noise is fixed, and then Alice wants to learn what the message was, kind of decode from the noise. So now all the Hilbert space dimensions are kind of fixed but mixed all over the place. So it's kind of similar to what you're saying. And then you add entanglement with them. Actually, there's something you said that was interesting. Now imagine if you had this third space, said, like you have, or ABC, let's say. Now just defining, now you have a correlation that could be generated on this. What is the minimum Hilbert space dimension in general? And I'm not sure. In this case, you can assume that they're both the same size by doing this argument. But I don't think this will work when you have three. You know, one obstacle is the Schmidt decomposition. But also, I think there's some examples where you have some marginals. If you know the marginals on A and B, and they're, say, three-dimensional, then the last one has to be, like, six-dimensional or something. Like, it's just a consistency problem. Yeah, no, there's a lot going on there.
So, thinking about your proof, where you start with trace for a squared and then get an expression in terms of the fidelity.
Yep.
And then you use with a contractive property that you can add.
Yes.
I mean, there's lots of other things you could look at besides the fidelity that have that property. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if there are sort of other bounds that you could get by looking at other distance measures between quantum states and how they relate to the dimension.
So, actually, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I actually have a new proof of that, that kind of avoids the fidelity, and does use some other kind of contractive things. But it's really fresh, and I didn't want to talk about it in case I embarrass myself. But there is a way to kind of get around this and use other functions.
And does it give you better bounds?
So, what we're able to do is actually, it seems, you know, I don't want to. It's not written in stone yet, but I think we can get more Ys here. Mm-hmm. So the fact we can get around this fidelity issue.
Can you explain what the more Ys?
Yeah.
Because you already allowed your Ys.
Ah, yes, okay. So right here, you're allowed to range over any choice of Bob's measurement, Y1 and Y2. But now we have a bound that says minimum over Y1, Y2, Y3, Y4, and more. So if you have something like I3322, where there's three measurement settings, you might get stronger bounds. And as a result, actually, I can stop this slide. We can actually get a bound on when you put any integer here, not just two. You get 3, 4, all the way up to n. It basically involves just rewriting the proof and avoiding fidelity.
What kinds of distance measures between quantum states are you using in that case, if not fidelity?
It's actually not a distance measure at all. We're just using the Euclidean norm. Okay. So if you want to prove the contractive property of fidelity, if you actually just dig O'Neilson and Trong and look at the details, it's basically just, I think it's just Cauchy-Schwarz or some Euclidean norm bounding. So if you just kind of abstract everything away and just look at that, you can get around this. Yeah, and I'm not sure what I think there's a lot of these things might be able to get be strengthened, at least for larger settings, like I3322 or the Schmidt coefficients. I think maybe if you have bounds for other integers, not just two, maybe you can do some more. You can pin down states a lot better, not just maximally entangled, but maybe other states. Or actually these generalized entropies. Now we can just do it for any n, basically. Right. So now I don't know exactly what this would mean yet, but it's something I want to look into. Yeah.
And then there's one other argument I didn't follow about non-convexity. So the first example of non-convexity.
The Bell setting?
Yes. At P1, P2, P3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right here. Yep.
Yeah, can you go over that argument again?
So these are actually deterministic strategies. So this is on input x and y. The first one just has Alice outputting 1. they both output one. Okay? There's no randomness. The second one, they just output zeros. And the last one, they just output A or B not equal to the input. Okay? So these are.
We're imagining that these are all binary variables. So
yes.
Well.
Yes. That's right. These are deterministic.
You could write A is equal to not X and B is equal to not Y.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, if you take the midpoint of this and you want to say, hey, can I generate this using a qubit? You cannot. And.
Just follows from plugging it into your bound and
stuff comes out. Yeah. If you just plug it into this. And Ellie showed this also in his work with John Donahue.
But every one of those individual distributions can be generated.
Yep.
Qubit, obviously.
You generate for one dimension. You don't need a qubit, actually.
Right.
Now, we were wondering, so our lower bound here is 3, and something Ellie and I discussed, whether you can get up to 4. Or maybe you know this now, but no, okay. So we're wondering if you could, if you needed 4.
So the statement here is that the joint distribution over A and B for any given value of X and Y is a non-convex set. Because PAB given XY, you know, if I'm varying over X and Y as well, you know, that's not itself a joint distribution, but it seems to me your argument is strong enough to say for every one of the 4 joint distributions, they're non-convex. Am I right about that? Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. But now I am taking into account all, like, maybe X and Y.
Like, that whole thing as a vector. But I'm not sure. What do you think, Ellie? Do you have a feeling?
I'm just wondering why you would think that. Like, what's the motivation to assume that it would work?
Sorry. I don't know. I guess I was just wondering. Just trying to interpret. So you're telling me that I should think of these as as functions of all 4 variables. And it's only when I think of them that way that I can prove non-convex.
I don't know if it's the only time.
Okay, but that's what you have.
It does work, yeah.
Okay.
Now, it could be the case that it has to be non-convex for some choice of x and y. That could be true.
Yeah, like if I take x equals 0, y equals 1, then there are 4 different deterministic guys.
Yeah.
Because the A and B in the last one would be 1, 0, which is not in the other 2. And I don't know.
I'm guessing there exists X and Y such that this is non-convex.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
that would be my feeling.
Without any sharing any sort of classical randomness, you can access any product distribution. So with a qubit, you can certainly access anything which is a mixture in 2 product distributions, not just deterministic ones. But any 2 product distributions, their convex combination, you can achieve with 1 bit of shared randomness or 1 qubit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you're talking about 2 outcomes and no measurements, then the set spanned by any 2 product distributions is the entire set.
Because right now, if you have a non-convex set and you have these 4 projections, which is basically just fixing x and y, I think one of them might have to be non-convex. At least the picture in my head, I don't know. I'd have to write it down. But.
Anyway, yeah, I'll think about that. It could be true. Okay, let's talk about this one.
You mentioned that under the promise of a dimension being given to you,
yes.
So promise this is a generated from a certain correlation.
Yes.
Then, in certain cases, you can say, well, now it must be maximally entangled.
That's right.
Right. Or more generally, you can see something about the entanglement, right? So that the
if it's pure state, yes. Yep.
Right. In device independent characterization. Often you want to take a correlation, and you say from this correlation, I want to say that without the promise of dimension, mm-hmm. this must be your state, and moreover, these must be your measurements.
Yes.
Can you do anything about like the complementarity of the different bases under the promise of a dimension? Not just do I contain like the C?
So kind of like halfway in between nailing down the states exactly and the measurements exactly, but something else.
Something about the measurements and something about the state under the promise.
Well, if you have two measurements that are complementary, the outcomes, do they always have to be independent? I think so. Or is that? Oh, you mean complementary, like Alice's, Bob's one measurement is this, and Bob's second measurement is this. Or are you saying Bob's one measurement is this, and Alice's other measurement is complementary? Do you know which one?
I think you're talking about incompatibility. If I see a violation of Bell inequality, not mm-hmm. only can I conclude that the state was entangled, but that the pair of observables measured on each side must be incompatible on commuting.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
So, not that I know of, is the short answer. Yeah. Because right now, actually, we're just characterizing the Schmidt coefficients. We actually say nothing but the measurements. Measurements are just kind of these things that just have to be there. And we're only talking about this. It might be possible, though. OK, it wouldn't surprise me if it was possible to some extent. Yeah.
Can you go to the slide where you found the lower bound that was composed of a product of lower bounds?
Yes.
So there was something I missed there. Was that? That was for product distributions of the different scenarios?
Yeah, so you had a bunch of independent experiments. And there was no correlations between the experiments, basically.
So
if you think about it, the lore, like, it's kind of, should be obvious.
That's
your question was it obvious?
It felt like it was either obvious or impossible, depending on whether you were allowing correlations between the different scenarios.
No, I think in retrospect, it was, it seems like it should be obvious. I actually haven't tried to prove it in any other kind of way. So I'm not sure how easy it would be to prove. I guess the way I view this is more of a sanity check. You know, a good lower bound should be able to capture this behavior. And luckily it did. And it actually wasn't obvious. When someone asked me this, I'm like, oh, I don't think it does. And then I went back and actually looked at her bound and just kind of worked it all out, and it does just pull apart.
Here's a proposal for another problem you might be able to tackle.
Yeah, please.
So it's well known that if I have, you know, an arbitrary CP map, then I can find spring dilate it using an ancilla of dimension d squared, dimension of the system, in a pure state. So if instead my ancilla is a smaller dimension d, but it's allowed to be mixed, okay? You get an interesting non-convex subset of the CP maps. So for a single qubit, if I tell you you have access to a single qubit ancilla, but it's allowed to be in a mixed state, you get a funny non-convex subset of CP maps.
Interesting.
And so certainly if I did, you know, prepare and measure in such a way that it was sort of tomographically complete for the CP map, that correlational data which would be able to teach me something. You know, if it's one of the CP maps that's outside that set, then it would teach me that the dimension of the ancilla has to be greater than 2.
Yes.
But in general, you could just ask, okay, if I've got prepare measure correlations, and I want to know a bound on the dimension of the ancilla that could have added that noise.
Mm-hmm.
So roughly speaking, you're kind of looking at the weakness of the correlations and asking, well, where did all that noise come from? I needed a noise source, and maybe I can put a lower bound on the dimension of the ancilla because I needed so much noise to see that. Yeah, it's a kind of a different problem, but it's
It's the same thing.
Also dimension bound, it's just an unconventional.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
I mean, it might be difficult to pick out the noise which was added by the channel versus the noise that was added after the channel.
All the noise comes from the ancilla in this example. So it's, I imagine a spine spring dilation, so it's a unitary. I have an input, an output, and all the noise is chunked coming from this quantum ancilla. No other source of noise. Well, okay. Yeah. I guess when you convert it into your classical preparation variable, your classical measurement variable, I guess you could also have sources of noise there.
If what's coming out on the other end is done with the POVN, then your POVN with a large Hubbard dimension can generate anything.
Yeah. Still. Hmm. Maybe there's.
Yeah. All right. I think we should call it a day. Thank you very much. And we should have coffee and keep going.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.